One thing I thought we might do, since I ran out of time, as I quite frequently do, I thought I would just show you. Can we put up some slides in just a second? Not now, but just a second. Not until I give you the signal. Thank you. I thought I might just point out one thing that I promised to do earlier, and I ran out of time, and that is, let me just show you something real quick. I think I can pull it up real quick. Here it is. I said earlier that I would explain. Okay, now you can bring up the slide. The explanatory filter of Bill Dembski. Okay. This morning I mentioned, if you were here in the morning service, I said there's the three-step filter. And the explanatory filter works this way. It takes any phenomenon or event or object X. You can think of it as an event or an object. And it asks if it can be explained, first of all, by law, like a predictable event. Okay, I drop the ball, it falls. I drop it a second time, it falls. I do it 30 times, it falls. It's a very predictable event. It's 100, nearly 100% predictable. It's produced by the law of gravity. See that? High probability events are law-like in their explanation. What about an event such as chance? Let's say I hand out cards to you guys, the people in the front row. And the lady in the pink, okay, keeps getting time after time a royal flush in spades. Well, let's just say it happens once. A royal flush in spades has a chance of 1 out of 2.5 million. Literally, it's 590,960. But we'll round that off to 2.5 million. So if we hand it out on our first try, everybody's excited. They throw a party. They break out the raspberry iced tea and some cake, and we celebrate. I mean, you could be a poker player your whole life and not have that happen. It happens then a second time. No one's laughing. No one's partying. Why? Somebody cheated, obviously. And if it happened a third time, fourth time, fifth time, sixth time, what we do is if chance can explain a single royal flush in spades, but it can't explain multiple. Low probability, let me just put it this way. Intelligent design is indicated. If event X passes through the final filter, which is that it's a specified pattern, if it's low probability and if it's an ideal specified pattern, in this case it's a highly specified pattern, before we even handed out the cards, we had already specified this hand is the ideal. You know, jack, king, queen, ace, jack, 10 jack, king, queen, ace, all in spades, 1 out of 2.5 million. That's already specified, prior specification, and if it hits it time after time after time, we know that somebody's monkeyed, right? Some intelligent, evil intelligence has monkeyed with the cards. And how do we know that? Did I kind of meditate and get a kind of a supernatural? No. The laws of physics and chemistry and math all produce this result through a careful filtering system. And what they do is they take a single, like, gene or protein, and they put it through the filter. And if you have, let's say, an assemblage of four genes working together, it gets caught. It's lower than 1/10 to the 150th power. It's specified it had to be designed. Okay, that's just one teeny corner of the genome of the whole package of DNA. That's my Dembski filter story or explanation. That's the best I can do in 5 minutes, okay? I fulfilled my promise. Okay, Q&A, this side.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, thank you. Did somebody pay you to say that? I was hoping somebody would say that. Because it's really it's a trial of great interest. Okay, now what happened is the Dover trial, number one, the school board, and I hate to say this, but they were just dumb. I mean, they handled it wrong from the get-go, in my opinion. I'm trying to be mean and nasty, but they were just unwise. Because the Discovery Institute, which runs the intelligent design movement day to day, the Discovery Institute has repeatedly advised school boards, whether it be state or local, do not require intelligent design, this very young, very new theory, to be taught, because it exposes then their requirement to being interpreted as political or religiously slanted. So we believe that the theory will triumph. We believe that it's triumphing in the laboratory. What they do want people to do is require that when evolution is taught, both the pro and con and against evidence be taught. Now, that's a no-brainer. If they had required that evolution be taught more honestly so that the problems with the evidence are brought out, the ACLU wouldn't have had a leg to stand on. But instead of following the recommendation of just bringing the pro and con of the current theory, they brought out the new theory. Now, I don't think the policy was bad. They said, they basically have a little statement. There's a book in the library that explains this other theory if you want to check it out. And then they left. That's 30 seconds. That's not even telling them anything about it. Just saying there's a book in the library. That's harmless. And the ACLU gets all worked up, but they still, were unwise. Now, what the judge did is he came down hard on the school board and said they had religious motives. We knew that we would lose on that point. That's the narrow point. What we hoped that he would just stay out of was this whole area of whether intelligent design is legitimate science. And so he traipsed into that area. By the way, there's a book that came out 3 days ago called Traipsing into Evolution. You can even order it on Amazon. It's the Discovery Institute is basically ripping apart and shredding the Dover trial decision in part two. What he did is he came out and basically everything said by the ACLU, he just honored. He gave great love and patience to every argument they had, and he had very short patience or no patience with any of our scientific credible testimony. He ignored and poo-pooed our whole side, 100% favored the other side, and pronounced intelligent design is just religion. Okay, and which we feel is an abominable decision, and it was so bad and so riddled with errors. Michael Behe alone, just in the science section of that Dover trial, found 20 major errors of either fact or illogic. Just in the science section, he's published on the discovery.org his own critique of that, and that's the appendix in this new book, Traipsing into Evolution. So it's such a bad decision. It's such an over-the-top, like, blundering in. I mean, what does a judge know about science and or philosophy? That's just not his training. He can't pontificate like he's on top of some mountain and tell everybody what this is or is not. So we believe his decision is so egregious, so terribly, poor and just riddled with errors, it will actually boomerang against the evolutionists and be a huge bonanza. I think it's already been a huge bonanza for us. It's energized and unified the idea movement like nothing else. So that's my take on Dover. Thank you for asking the question. Okay.
Hi. I got on the internet today an article. They found a skull in Ethiopia. And it is the missing link.
Oh, a skull in Ethiopia is the missing link.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. The link between the extinct Homo erectus and modern man, if you'd like to see it.
Oh, sure, yeah. And do you have a question about that? Okay. Ethiopia skull, at least 250,000 years old. Scientists in northeast Ethiopia said Saturday they've discovered the skull of a small human ancestor that could be. Notice the key words, could be. Yeah. A missing link between the extinct Homo erectus and modern man, et cetera, et cetera. Thank you. Can I have this? Okay. What I didn't say about human evolution is that, in my opinion, the evidence for transitional forms from apes to man is way overblown. It's very poor, very lent to personal interpretation. Paleoanthropology, the study of ancient man, is known to have huge doses of subjective, moving the fossils around. This has been shown over and over that if you just manipulate the little, specimens, the little splinters of fossil that you have, fossil bone, that you can make the face look almost any way you want it to look, depending on how you tug and pull and arrange these pieces. Now, the afarensis, Australopithecus afarensis, the Lucy skeleton, which you may have heard about, it's been in the news for 25 years now. It was discovered in the Afar region of Ethiopia. That extinct ape, which is always said to be on its way to being human, has been shown by a British anthropologist, Sir Solly Zuckerman, to not have actually walked upright. He did a whole, multivariable analysis on the Lucy ape, published a book on it, and his book was filed in the back and ignored. Why? Because it was throwing water on their excited, expectations that this would be the extinct link to mankind. To me, if you can't cross the chasms between one phylum, vertebrates, and another phylum, let's say arthropods, if you can't find any links across that chasm, that's where you test the theory, not between extinct forms that are so close morphologically that you could have had many varying extinct forms that to the eye of faith could fit in that sequence. Where you test the theory is where it should have the biggest, you know, pattern of transitions, which is between one phylum and another. And I think that the focus on human fossils, while important and understandable, misses the point. If Darwinism fails at the most fundamental level, evolving phyla, then how can it succeed at the higher level or the more dinky level of between one species and another, or one genus or one family and another? You see my point? Now, the dating of the fossils, I'd be glad to go into that in a little bit more if we want to go into that, and maybe I can in just a minute. Back to over here.
Mm-hmm. Is that why do we see organisms such as you showed tonight? Why don't we see them next to like a modern day animal such as a dog? Like why do they seem to be layered out in such a way?
That's a very, very good question, and I don't have a good answer when it comes down to the Cambrian level. To me, one of the mysteries of the Cambrian, and I'm just telling you, this is a point against my own point of view. My own point of view is that the flood laid down all the fossils from the Cambrian on up, the Noaic flood. And that's a pretty standard young Earth view, okay? The problem with that view, and I think it's important to bring this out, is that you would expect swimming down there among these sea creatures, the marine creatures, you'd expect ordinary bony fish. There's, what, 8,000, I think, over 8,000 species of bony fish today, and you don't see them down there. So, I mean, you could put forward a theory. I'm not saying this is my theory, but someone could put forward a theory that just prior to day one, there was a earlier Earth, and Satan was there, and the Cambrian animals were there, and Satan fell, and God hit the Earth with a disaster and wiped it out, and so there was this earlier kind of pre-flood, you know, and then God started over, and everything above the Cambrian, where you find bony fish, is the later phase. I'm not saying that's my theory, but I've heard people propose that. I'm just basically, I'm still of the opinion that the 6 days are normal days. When I say still, it sounds like I'm slipping. No, I'm just comfortably accepting the opinion of the understanding, putting its scientific and biblical evidence together, that the days are normal days, and that the global flood, I'm convinced, overwhelmingly convinced, that the global flood described in Genesis 6 through 9 was global. And what you find around the world seems to be the vestiges of that kind of catastrophe. But I admit, I'm the first to tell my students in my classes at Trinity, the best evidence, if you will, if you're going to attack my point of view, is to go down the Cambrian and point out it's a mystery, the bony fish. There are people at Bryan College, a guy who trained over under Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard. This guy at Bryan College, a strong Christian, Kurt Wise, has a new theory that it was ecological zonation will account for the lack of bony fish in the Cambrian. That's his theory. Okay, back over here.
I actually had a different question, mm-hmm. But the previous one over here made me think of something else.
Mm-hmm.
If you say yourself to be a creationist or mm-hmm. A believer in intelligent design...
I'm both.
That doesn't necessarily prevent you from accepting the existence of Cro-Magnon man or Neanderthal man. They could be different species.
Absolutely.
That appeared,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Cro-Magnon, by the way, was modern man. Everybody agrees. If you put Cro-Magnon in the audience, you would not notice him. Cro-Magnon is 100% modern man.
But Neanderthal was not considered.
Neanderthal was at one point was considered by most people in this area to be a side branch of the human tree. The new evidence appears to show that he was not a side branch. I haven't studied the evidence in enough data depth. I haven't studied the new data in enough depth to say with dogmatic either he was a side branch of the human tree. In other words, like, you know, let's say Aborigines, fully human but just not around. Or whether he was a separate, you know, species that was just, you know, ape-like. I'm inclined to think that Neanderthal man was part of the modern human family, and some of the data that we've seen separating him is not going to hold water. That's my personal view. Okay. Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah. So the question, I guess, is if we accept that Neanderthal man existed. Mm-hmm. But
he did. He definitely, right, yeah. The dad is very, very good for Neanderthal.
So he existed. Mm-hmm. She existed. Whatever that
they existed.
They existed. So mm-hmm. As Christians, when we study Scripture, mm-hmm. it doesn't address any kind of non-complex human behavior. I mean, it always talks about really complex things. Mm-hmm. So when we hear about this Neanderthal man doing very archaic activities, mm-hmm. you know, writing on cave walls and mm-hmm. barely even being able to invent metals and fire. How does that translate in Scripture when we don't really have any mention of non-complex behavior?
Well, I think when we were talking earlier,
So that's the
We were talking about Deuteronomy 29:29. The things
that's the unwritten stuff that maybe we just
I think that God, the secret things belong to the Lord, Deuteronomy 29:29, and yet the things that are revealed to us belong to us and our children forever. And I mean, I think that God gives every encouragement to try to extrapolate, fill in the blanks as much as we can from scientific data, given the parameters and the guidelines of Scripture. And I think that at some point you have to say, my understanding of Scripture is that the basic story is boom, and just come up with your basic understanding. And I understand that there are a lot of people who believe in what's called progressive creation. Does everybody know what progressive creation means? It means that the long timeline, as given by modern science, is true. That Earth cooled 4.1 billion years, that the first bacteria appeared 3.8 billion, the first complex animals exploded in the Cambrian explosion, 540, just a half a billion. Some Christians, probably 90%, this may shock you, okay, but 90% of the scientists in the idea movement accept this progressive creation. Now, that doesn't mean they buy Darwinism. They utterly reject Darwinism because they don't believe that anything evolved macro, okay? Everything was just introduced and plugged in by the Creator when the time was right. It's like adding more and more floppy disks, or I guess, you know, CDs, whatever, to your hard drive. You just keep putting more and more files in. And that's the picture of progressive creation. I'm not a progressive creationist, okay? I hold to the young Earth view. So I'm kind of rare in the ID movement, okay? Thank you for those questions. Next.
Yeah, I guess my question kind of merges with what you were just saying, is I think the Christian community has to come up with one standard and decide, is the Earth 20,000 years old, or is it 4 billion years old? Because until, I think, the religious community comes to one consensus on that, they're not going to be able to persuade the secular community of our point of view. Because, I mean, how can you differentiate? Well, you got some Christians say the Earth's 10,000 years old, other Christians say it's 4 billion years old. You know, come to a consensus.
Well, okay, let me just interact with that. I appreciate your passion. I appreciate your thought that, you know, a unified position. You know, I could see advantages if there were unified. I mean, then we, you know, because one of the things you guys can't even, you know, decide among yourselves, you know, how God did it or when he did it or whatever. At the same time, I think that, you know, okay, I'm just trying to put this. It's a fairly complex thing I want to say and bring it down to a brief answer. I would say that the diversity of viewpoint that we have under this huge umbrella of intelligent design is actually a positive. It's an advantage. It's a plus. For this reason, we are unified on what I think is the most important thing at all, thing of all. We're not, as it were, I mean, it would be nice to have unity in the time frame and how to interpret Genesis. That would be a nice thing. But the most important thing, if you're going to get down to the most important fundamentals, and this is a new kind of fundamentalism, okay? I'm a fundamentalist in several areas. I believe in the Scriptures. I believe in inerrancy. Okay, I believe in all of the fundamental doctrines. But when it comes to science, I'm a different kind of fundamentalist. I think the most fundamental issue is not the timing or speed of creation, but whether there was a creator at all. Okay, I think that's the most fundamental point. And on that fundamental point, this umbrella that embraces all the diversity of viewpoints has unified the spectrum of doubters about Darwin like nothing else has. And so we have this fantastic unity, and almost we have the fun of comparing. You know, in other words, iron sharpens iron. There's that verse in Proverbs. As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens the countenance of another, I think is the way it words. And so that's like, you know, so when I meet with, let's say, Michael Behe, you know, I give him a hug. We're good friends. I hope he's a brother in Christ. He's told an audience at Texas A&M he has a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. I'm encouraged by that. Michael Behe and I get together, and he, shock of shocks, accepts the common ancestry tree. I mean, well, how can he be a member of the ID movement? Because he absolutely doubts the Darwinian story that nature drove it, that natural selection drove it. He absolutely believes God programmed every single one of those complex machines. Now, he has a theory that there was a master cell, like the superbacteria, that was loaded down with all these hard drive, you know, with flagellum, you know, files that wouldn't need to be turned on until later, and other files that wouldn't need to be turned on, blood clotting files that would be kind of, I think that's implausible. So we have fun kind of, you know, comparing theories. But we're unified on the issue of whether there was a creator or, to put it another way, whether Darwin's theory is holding water. And everybody under this tent, the umbrella, absolutely radically doubts Darwin's theory. And this is becoming a bigger and bigger tent. Let me make an announcement. 1 week ago, we started a new organization in Florida, which is going to go nationally and globally, and it's a unifying under that same kind of umbrella of all physicians and surgeons who doubt Darwin's theory. It's called Physicians and Surgeons for Scientific Integrity. The board is based in Florida, but we already have a medical doctor in Anchorage, Alaska, who's on our board, and he says, I can get you 50 to 60 doctors here in Anchorage who doubt Darwin's theory. When I got that email, I kind of got charged up. You know, I didn't know if there were that many bears in Anchorage, Alaska. I thought there were more bears than doctors. He can find 60 doctors. I said, we can find maybe 100 doctors in Philadelphia, okay, and the Christian doctors. So if you know of any physician, who's a surgeon, who's a Christian, or maybe even skeptic of Darwinism, doesn't matter what denomination, if you can hand me a little name, that would help. Because we'd like to get 10,000 doctors signing onto this list. There's a 500 scientists that have signed onto a list of skepticism at discovery.org. We'd like to, on our PSSI, Physicians and Surgeons for Scientific Integrity, PSSIinternational.org, I think it is, we'd like to have 10,000 doctors. And then we'd like to go national and show in a national broadcast Unlocking the Mystery of Life. So we're sponsored by doctors. You know, your family doctor has brought you the following broadcast to help you to understand Darwinism. I think that would be a cool thing. Thank you for the good question. Over to you.
Oh, hi. First, I just want to say that I'm a college student, and recently I've actually been getting a lot of flack that my friend's like, you believe in creationism? What, are you crazy?
Wow.
And I actually want to thank you for coming here. This has been really helpful.
Thank you.
And I have two questions.
First, you have to promise to show the unlocking video?
If I can get hold of it.
Sure. I will give you one, okay? Is that okay? Okay. I think we can provide one for you. Okay.
Two questions. First, what do you say about neo-Darwinism and their idea of punctuated equilibrium?
Okay, punctuated equilibrium. I mentioned it in one of the three services this morning, like in about one sentence, and that's not enough, okay? Stephen Jay Gould, I mentioned him earlier, had a quote by him in the morning service. I don't think I brought him in that. Well, he's the one that brought out abrupt appearance followed by stasis. He championed that two-step pattern. Gould recognized back in the 70s that the classic picture of gradual evolution, everything going gradually, step by slow, step by slow, step, was having problems in the fossil record. Because the fossil record almost never, not never, but almost never, shows gradual change, these meandering branches shooting out new kinds of forms. Instead, what they would find is a kind of a shell here, and you go up two levels, and the shell has tweaked slightly, but it's still the same, basically. You go up five levels, it's still there. There may be three or four variations, but it's just variations on a theme, okay? And he thought, and so he came up with the idea that if animals exist in a large population, let's say as big as Philadelphia, and maybe there's a little island in the middle of the Delaware River, and some at low tide, some of these, let's say, hamsters scamper across. They don't have low tide in rivers. What do they do? Okay, let's go to the South Carolina coast, okay? They have low tide there. Okay, at low tide off the South Carolina coast, these hamsters or whatever, rats, scamper across, and then they get isolated, and the mom and the pop and the babies settle down on the island, and they're separated. And the separate, like, isolated group is small, and so mutations in their DNA and their proteins can happen more rapidly. In other words, they can spread rapidly through that small population. And if macro, big mutations spread rapidly in a small population, maybe you can convert a rat into a bat in a matter of 10,000 years instead of millions of years. And so, because the change is happening in little teeny pockets at the edge of a large population, so you don't have that many to begin with, and it's happening so fast because they're mutating in this little isolated group, that maybe you can blink an eye and miss the transitions, and then all of a sudden there's a new animal. That's, in a nutshell, what his theory is. Rapid speciation, rapid development of new structure in a small isolated population out at the periphery of a large population mediated through strong macro mutations. I think I've done an adequate job of explaining punctuated equilibrium. So you have equilibrium, that's the stasis, and then you have the punctuation mark. Okay, that's where you have the boom, there's a new species. Where'd that come about? Well, it was a little group out there in the periphery, and they rapidly mutated and evolved. The problem with this theory is that it's based on the absence of evidence. If you ask any geneticist, what genetics, what genetical evidence do we have that animals are that plastic, that they can evolve that rapidly, new form, new structure, new organs, new body systems, they will say, we don't have any evidence. Bacteria have remained unchanged for 150 years. Bacteria have been studied, and they have yet to observe. Alan Linton, bacteriologist, world-famous bacteriologist, British bacteriologist, has written publicly, we have studied bacteria for 150 years. We have seen not one new species of bacteria evolve under our nose. That's just bacteria. So if that's how stable and, you might say, stasis-oriented bacteria are, then I don't think his punctuated equilibrium theory has a ghost of a chance. And I think it's come under heavy fire. I mean, people love it because it's kind of an escape route. It's another tool in their toolkit. Does that help?
Yes, it does.
Okay, thank you.
I have one other question. I'm sure you've probably heard about this, but have you heard about the flying spaghetti monster?
Yes.
My friends mentioned that. Like, it makes just as much sense that some flying spaghetti monster made everything as if God made everything. Mm-hmm. It's like this spoof religion people are making up just kind of mock the idea of intelligence.
Yeah, that's not worthy of even being replied to, in my opinion. It's their exercise in irrelevance. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, you're now saying, what's the flying spaghetti monster? You have to Google it, okay? You can see pictures of this mass of spaghetti with some meatballs flying through the air, and it's supposedly creating things. You said, what does that have to do? It doesn't have to do with anything. It's kind of they're making fun, they're mocking God, and we're saying we're like believing in the flying spaghetti monster to believe in God. Isn't that strange? Okay.
How accurate is the dating of fossils? Because
how accurate?
Yeah, my interpretation of the Bible is that God created Adam, mm-hmm. and then he created the animals, and Adam named the animals.
Well, that's what it says in Genesis 2. If you go with the Genesis 1 sequence, he's creating the sea and air creatures on day 4. And then, on day 5, and then on day 6, he's creating the land animals. And actually, he created the plants. The vegetable kingdom was created on day 3 when the continents appeared. So it would be plants, then sea and air, which is probably birds and fish and other, like, let's say, aquatic mammals and other marine animals, and then land animals. The Genesis 2 account can be correlated by different means. I would say that the dating of fossils to these ancient eras is dependent upon the radiometric dating. Now, there's a common misconception. People think carbon dating is used. Now, that's a minor point, but let me make it. Because I've had probably 500 people ask me, what about carbon dating? And I have to keep saying this over and over and over. Is everybody listening? Okay. I'm going to tell you the facts about carbon dating. You may shock, you may fall off your pew, but that's okay. Don't fall hard, okay? Carbon dating has never once been used to date one fossil by anyone. Carbon dating has never once been used by any scientist of any kind to date anything in the nature of a fossil. Carbon dating is only used to date human artifacts. What they do use, you say, well, what's the big deal about carbon dating? Well, carbon dating dates things that have carbon in them and that can decay very rapidly. Carbon dating, I would argue, is valid at least back to the time of the flood, when atmospheric conditions may have changed the amount of radioactive carbon that's produced per year and is then integrated in organisms. I think that the carbon dating of the Shroud of Turin is probably accurate. So I take it that the Shroud of Turin is probably not anything related to the person of Christ. Okay, that's my personal view. I may be, crushing people's beliefs or hopes or whatever. So carbon dating is not really, but uranium-lead dating is valid. And I'm saying it's valid, but it's used, okay? Rubidium, strontium, potassium, argon, there's several other newer tests. These are used to show that, let's say, this fossil is really 500 million years old because it's found in a lead deposit area in Russia, and we dated the lead, and we found the daughter element of uranium, U-238, has decayed into this amount of lead-232. Therefore, it's this many, hundreds of millions of years old. The only problem with that is it's called the boundary condition. The boundary condition is how much daughter element, because the mother produces the daughter. The mother is uranium. The daughter is a certain kind of lead. Now, what if there was some of the daughter element there already when the formation was laid down? You see? Okay, let's use the analogy. I'm putting $1 a day into my dresser drawer. Okay, I look in there, there are $20. How many days? 20 days. But what if the first day I already had $10 in there? Well, then that's only been 10 days. What if the first day I had $18 in there? Then I've only been putting dollars in for 2 days. You see the problem? The initial boundary conditions, what you had there to start with, determines the validity of your rate, you know, projection. You see? And if there was plenty of, and so the dollars in the drawer represents the lead already present in that strata when the strata was laid down. Now, how does this date back? According to the theory of how heavy elements are produced, they're produced in the cores of stars that then explode and scatter their debris throughout the cosmos. So according to this theory, it shouldn't date back to the time that the formation was laid down. It should date to the moment when some star over here on the other side of the galaxy blew up and began to scatter its debris everywhere. At that point, U-238 was beginning the countdown. In other words, it was beginning the decay process. So I find the lead, uranium lead, and other kinds of radiomagnetic dating just riddled with assumptions and problems. The coup de grace, what just completely cuts it off, is when you turn a sample over to any of the major labs, they don't just take the sample and put it in a little bag and start to analyze it. You know what they ask you to do? They ask you to fill out a form. Where did you find it? Approximately at what level was it found? Like, give me a hint. You know, am I getting warm? What? I thought this was subjective. I thought you could just take the thing, put it through your atom analyzer, see how much of the radioactive mother and the non-radioactive daughter element is there, and poof, you know, read out on the computer screen. This is so many years. You're telling us we have to give you a hint? The reason they do that is if they're outside the zone where you know, let's say this has this level rock above and this level rock below, then if they give you a reading that's way out here, they can kind of, you know, massage the data and bring it down. Well, that's illegitimate, I think. Philip Johnson has pointed out how ridiculous this whole thing is of dating strata that way. Is that okay?
The reason I'm saying that is because if you date the Bible, maybe generations through the Bible, man's been on the earth for approximately 6,000-7,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they getting the info of man being here for hundreds of thousands of years?
Yeah.
Oh,
I think that I think everything was created, biologically was created within the last 10,000 years, okay? And I'm using the ballpark that John Whitcomb, the famous creationist theologian, you know, from Grace Seminary uses, okay? Okay, back to her.
All right, great presentation.
Thank you.
The flagellum, was it?
Flagellum.
Mm-hmm. Flagellum. I just wanted to ask, did you say that was a bacteria? I missed that.
Yeah, the flagellum is one of the two motile systems that are found in Behe's book. He has a whole chapter on the flagellum, I think, and a separate chapter on the cilium. The cilium is a hair that whips back and forth like this, okay? It's got a very interesting structure also. It also is irreducibly complex. The flagellum is a rotary motor, a rotary tail. Flagellum, the cilium back and forth motion is very interesting. It would be funny if the hairs on my head move back and forth, okay? But the hairs on the interior of our windpipe that sweep, you know, mucus up the windpipe, those are cilia. They're ciliated cells by the millions covering the interior of your windpipe that are doing their little motion right now. And so the flagellum is found in bacteria. I think there's also some eukaryotes. In other words, some higher animals that also, if I remember, there are eukaryotes, which means above the level of bacteria that also have flagella, I think. So, good question.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hello?
Hello, doctor. Actually, I have just a two-part question. The first part is, I mean, it's pretty clear that Darwinist evolution is non-functional.
I think it's on its last legs, and I think it's very feeble, and I think it will fail within the next 10 to 20 years, for sure.
In fact, you could argue that it's essentially part of the pun, secular theology.
I would argue that. Mm-hmm.
Arguing, it's essentially that scientists argue it on faith alone, that they're superior to all of us people.
Well, yeah, we could discuss that.
now, with, I'd have to say that, I mean, intelligent design theory has much more of a broad base of scientific evidence to it. In fact, arguable scientific evidence. For instance, you mentioned that you and Dr. Behe argue as to in what nature intelligent design has taken place.
Mm-hmm.
Where does this go in the future, particularly since you have mentioned that there's another organizing school of thought?
Yeah. The other school of thought is it's a kind of ragtag movement of its own. You know, intelligent design is kind of a ragtag. Notice we don't have a huge organization. We don't have a lot of funding. And in that sense, I think that the analogy with the Star Wars movies, you know, fits. You know, you have the rebels who are kind of fleeing from base to base, and and we're being chased by, you know, the stormtroopers of the Empire. And I feel that way. It's almost that way right now. There's another ragtag movement which is opposed to the Empire, but is trying to kind of salvage it in a sense, kind of like Gorbachev. You know, I used the Gorbachev analogy this morning. Gould, I think, functioned something as a Gorbachev to rescue communism, remember, and kind of reform it. Gorbachev was doing that. Gould was trying to rescue and reform Darwinism with his punctuated equilibrium theory to explain the lack of transitions. Now, I think the OOF, okay, if you want to write down another note, this is time to do it. MIT Press wrote a book called, published a book called Origination of Organismal Form. And the two scholars that edited that collection, there's 20 authors, 20 scientists. The two editors are Mueller, M-U-L-L-E-R, a German guy, and Newman, Stuart Newman, who is at the Valhalla University of New York Medical College, Valhalla. Newman, I think, is an agnostic. Mueller, I assume, is an agnostic, although I've talked to Newman. That's private, by the way. Don't tell anybody. Like, oh, I'm going to go out and report that to AP. Woodward talked to Newman. But Newman and I have had a conversation, and he agrees that the Darwinian theory has come to its end. Now, that is a powerful conclusion to me, and a very, very courageous. And in his book, in the opening chapter, Mueller and Newman say absolutely heretical things. They keep saying over and over, now, Darwinian theory has helped to explain variety, the survival of the fittest, but it has not explained the arrival of the fittest. You get the difference? I mean, once it's there, like I think Jonathan Wells was saying, once they have the bacterial flagellum, you know, you can, in a natural selection, can weed out, you know, maybe some mutants, but it doesn't give you the black bacterial flagellum. That's what Newman is saying, you know, in this opening chapter of The Origination of Organismal Form. And then he says, Darwinism has no theory of the generative. And what he means by that is Darwinism has no theory of macroevolution. Now, to say that is absolutely devastating. And that's why Stephen Meyer, in his article on this Cambrian information explosion, quoted heavily from that book. I believe that the new theory that the Darwinists will jump into will be somewhat along. It's a very vague. It's got a lot of ideas, and they're working on this and that. But what they're doing is they're taking their focus out from the nucleus of a cell, where the DNA is coiled up. And they're looking out in the stuff outside the nucleus. And this is sometimes called the epigenetic. Epi means around, like outside the genes. Epigenetic paradigm. And they're saying, we're missing the boat by focusing just on the DNA. We need to look at the stuff around the DNA and other spaces in the cell. And if we look at how that changes, that'll explain how new form comes about. And I guess I could say, theoretically, I wish them well. But I think they will also crash and burn. It'll grow. You know, the story in Daniel, you know, the image that is destroyed by the rock, and then the rock grew and became a mountain and filled the whole earth. That refers to Jesus Christ. It also refers to the ID paradigm. That's a little heretical, okay? Thank you. Good questions.
I noticed when you were bouncing the electron, all the neutrinos fell off the pulpit.
All the neutrinos. Oh, my goodness. Now, neutrinos are ghost-like particles. Several million of them are passing through your body every second without giving you nary a tickle. Okay.
I've been trying to just put things in perspective on an idea that I've running around with. The Torah being the DNA for everything. Because it was written out a finite number of letters in specific order, and it looks like the string DNA code.
The Torah, the five books
of the Bible. Mm-hmm. So it just reminds me of that, and when I see references to where they're going into the DNA code for the diseases and such, it looks exactly like what they're using for the Bible code.
Okay, yeah, I don't want to really get in that much into the Bible code. Honestly, I do not I do not see in the Bible code movement any to me, cogent, you know, like indicators that God is really revealing something through these secret codes. Mm-hmm. I think, however, in general, the analogy between any portion of the Bible, and you cannot go almost more basic than the Torah, this genetic, the analogy between the information in the Torah and the information in genetic files is absolutely brilliant. I think it's a good analogy. Now, I would maybe, we can discuss perhaps afterwards, but I'm not really... Everything I've read of the Bible code movement has not has led me, as it were, to view it as not a, a fruitful path for apologetics.
Right.
Okay. So, but the other analogy works. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hi. My question is, why biology? And mm-hmm. what I mean is, when I not argue necessarily, when I'm discussing. One of the areas that's probably more complicated than any other to discuss is biology. I don't really know enough about it to feel like I can make an intelligent contribution even to a conversation. And then I ask, well, aren't there other sciences also? If evolution were a truth, if it were accurate, wouldn't some other sciences collaborate or substantiate what you're seeing in biology? Because biology, it's tough.
Well, yeah, biology is full of data and information and details. And what I would say, I mean, I don't know that much biology in terms of, well, you may say I don't know tons. I guess I know a certain amount of biology because I read on this constantly. But if you read, let me just give you your assignment, okay? This is your assignment. Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. Good place to start. If you want to get the whole picture, go back and read Michael Denton's book, Evolution, A Theory, and Crisis. If you read Michael Denton's book, Evolution, A Theory, and Crisis, by the way, which is still in print, it will blow you away. I remember when I read that book, and we were in the Dominican Republic, it had been sent me down there. For about 4 weeks, I had double devotions. I had my biblical devotions, then I went across the hallway, and I had my devotions in Denton. Okay, and Denton's not even a God believer. I mean, he's an agnostic who was shredding the Darwinian macro theory. So I would read Michael Denton's book, Evolution, A Theory, and Crisis. He's very well written. You'll understand, I think, pretty much everything if you just work your way through. It's 300 and some pages. Also read, I would say read Dawkins' book. Dawkins, the atheist, the crusading atheist evolutionist, his book is fabulously well written, and it will really get you thinking. I mean, if there's anything that kind of boomeranged in my experience, it was reading Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker. He thought he was converting the world. He made me more confident than ever in my creationist beliefs because of the way he argued. And it was Johnson read the two books side by side, Denton and Dawkins. Michael Behe, in his book at Lehigh, requires his students to read side by side Denton and Dawkins. They're just, and they're both from the mid-80s. Now that's a little bit dated. Also, Darwin on Trial by Philip Johnson, which I discuss, I analyze in my book, Doubts About Darwin. You can read my book, too. Nothing against that. Doubts About Darwin was written as a rhetorical history. So, you know, there's a couple words now and then you may have to look up. I admit that. Okay, so I apologize in advance, okay? Any trips to Webster's Dictionary. But the best place, I think, is Michael Denton's Evolution, A Theory, and Crisis. It is a crash course on this whole area. It will bless you. It will blow your mind. It will bless your socks off. And then why the other areas are, chemistry and physics deal more with laws. You see, laws of physics, laws of chemistry. Now, the physicists have gotten involved in fine-tuning, and they are talking about design. And especially this new work on the privileged planet, why the Earth seems to be perfectly stationed as an observation platform for the universe, for studying the universe. So that's my double answer to your double question. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. First off, you ended the video a bit early. Why doesn't the cooperational evolution work?
Co-option?
Yeah.
Yeah. Co-option is the major theory now used. It's the last stand, if you will, for evolution. I think it fails for a number of reasons. One reason is that co-option never brings in a testable hypothesis. It's a vague, what I call, hand-waving answer. Because if you ask anyone using the co-option theory, according to co-option, what specific pathway was used to get to the first assemblage of that needle-nose pump where you had 10 proteins working together? They have no explanation for that. And then if you go from 10 to 40, where did you get the other 30 proteins? Because the cell is just not churning out new helpful proteins all the time. A single protein One of these that stretches from here to the back of the auditorium is itself a world of high technology. Where one single protein, to me, is implausible on the face of it. And yet they're saying we're going to add an 11th and then a 12th and the 13th and the 14th and the 15th and on all the way up to the 40 protein flagellum. Okay, let's just assume for the moment that the cell is just popping out proteins like you pop, you know, popcorn in your microwave. Pop, pop, pop. Oh, these wonderful new proteins coming about. What is the pathway, the Darwinian pathway? Because remember, they're going by nature-driven alone. You cannot look ahead. There's no intelligence, no foresight, no planning. What is the Darwinian pathway by which led you steadily on from 11 to 12 to 13 to 14, maintaining some fitness or function along? And you know what they'll say? Our best people are working on that. They have no answer. It's back to just-so stories, Rudyard Kipling, just-so stories, and hand-waving. So co-option, in my view, is a desperate final lunge to try to stop the bandwagon of intelligent design. It is not even, in my view, it doesn't even come up to the level, minimum level of a rigorous scientific theory. It has no prediction to it and no rigor to it. So that's what I would say about co-option.
And also, assuming that Darwin's theory is completely wrong, why is intelligent design right?
Okay, because in any given setting, we know, we've learned a lot about the cause-effect structure of the universe. Okay, we know, for example, that the structures of the universe that we've observed, that we have empirical, direct observation of, that the anything that we observe that has high information content, and when I mean high information content, I'm talking about, let's say, a kilobyte of information. Not even a megabyte, but a kilobyte, okay, 1,000 bits, or kilobyte, yeah. Anyway, when you get to kilobytes of information, let alone megabytes or gigabytes, you have reached a level of information that we've never seen produced by what are called random or stochastic processes. We've done a lot of testing. I mean, we've done mimicked it in computers. We've seen it working in nature. And the natural causes are so unintelligent that they can maybe produce a small amount of information that is functional to maybe take a protein and tweak it, modify it slightly. But if you try to challenge unintelligent processes to produce a new protein, they fail, as the new experiments from Ralph Silke have demonstrated with bacteria. So what do we do then? We look, there's either intelligent causes or chance or scientific law. Now you can combine chance and scientific law, and you can say scientific law working with chance, so you can kind of combine those. But you have intelligent causes, chance, scientific law, or a combo. Those are your four explanatory options in terms of the major categories of explanation. Now, in our experience, do we see anything that indicates intelligence as the best, which this is what we call the inference to the best explanation? We want to do an inference either to A, B, C, chance and law combined, or D, intelligence. What we see in the cause-effect structure of the universe is that everything in our experience has intelligence producing information. So the inference to intelligence is not a guess. It's based on the observation of the uniformity of the universe around us. So when we say DNA is likely to have come from intelligence, we're just observing this cause-effect structure that we see working always, always, always around us in nature today. So I think that's a very robust, a very strong inference. It's called the inference to the best explanation, and I can give you a humorous illustration of that later on, which pertains to me catching the black lung disease, okay? You say, what's the black lung disease? Maybe I can tell that to conclude tonight, okay? That's my best stab at that.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm, just going into middle school, and it's going to be, my public school for the first time.
Okay.
And I was wondering, everyone's telling me that a lot of people are going to come after me with the biology and creation and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, what's, the biggest argument against Darwinism? And, is there a book I could read or something?
Okay. Can I plug a cartoon book? And it's a cartoon book that at middle school, this is middle school, you're, okay. At middle school, you're at the level where you can begin to understand this cartoon book. It's more for adults and like high schoolers, but I think you can get it. I'm kidding you not. It's called What's Darwin Got to Do With It? It's by InterVarsity Press. I would say that book you should read first. Okay. What's Darwin Got to Do With It? It's a cartoon book on this topic written for adults. And it's fantastic. So you can have maybe your mom and dad or a friend or a rich uncle get you that book. And I would say the best argument for design or against evolution is, again, informational macromolecules. Remember that phrase? Informational means bearing information, and macromolecules just means there's a long chain. And DNA looks like this, but it looks like a ladder. You saw it on the video, perhaps. I would get them a copy of the Unlocking the Mystery of Life video. It's a little bit of, you know, a little bit maybe advanced at places for middle school, but not too bad. And I would get them the Privileged Planet, and I would show them. I would have them in for maybe kind of watching it, you know, some night and just, you know, discuss it or something. And so the other video that I want to emphasize is Icons of Evolution. I didn't bring copies. It's fantastic, too. And the students in your school would love the Icons of Evolution DVD. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, for a follow-up. Okay. And sorry. I think we'll conclude with these three.
One recommendation I had for maybe this gentleman here is to read Josh McDowell. Because I think he does a nice job.
Which book?
The Evidence That Demands a Verdict.
Okay. And it's like a compendium.
I think it explains how to tell people that really in life there is no absolute. You have to go by the most plausible explanation that's the most logical. Mm-hmm. I mean, in law, there's nothing that says he's absolutely guilty or absolutely innocent. Mm-hmm. You have to go on what's the most logical explanation. So in intelligent design, mm-hmm. we can't prove the existence of God absolutely, but mm-hmm. we can show that it's the most logical explanation over Darwinism,
yeah.
right?
I think that the recent change of mind of Antony Flew bears that out. Antony Flew is a famous atheist philosopher. I don't know how many of you heard that a year ago he changed his mind. I mean, you talk about one of the sequoias of the world falling. He was 81, and some of the atheists, his fellow atheists, poo-pooed and said, "Oh, you're just getting too close. You know, you're checking out. You're cramming for finals. You know." So you're, you know, giving in to the God hypothesis as you get closer and closer to death. But Antony Flew says, "I don't want to live after death." I mean, he's not a Christian. He's become a deist, but he has come to believe in God. And you know what convinced him? Information in DNA. He said there's too much information in the genetic system of the single cell. I didn't bring this out, but you need 250. They've just figured out in the last 5 years, they tried to figure out what's the minimal system you have to the barely functioning simple cell. They say it may be around 1,200 genes. That's 1,200 files. But for sure, it can't get lower than 250 because we have very lazy, what are called mycoplasma, and they're parasitic bacteria. The parasitic bacteria, which are so challenged, I mean, they're like a lazy cousin who loafs by the swimming pool of a rich uncle all day long, fed trays of food by belt butlers, okay, can't do a thing. Just barely survives. Some of these lazy bacteria get along with as few as 400 genes. And they said, well, maybe you could take these away. You can't get lower than 250 genes. That's the minimal functioning cell. And if a single bacterial gene or DNA string is a miracle, then to believe in the random assemblage of the first cell is like allowing or somehow by faith believing in 250 miracles end to end in rapid succession happening in the same spot. I don't have that much faith. I'm sorry. I do not have enough faith to be an atheist or a macroevolutionist or a chemical evolutionist. I just can't manage the leaps of faith.
That's the point. That's,
yeah.
Could you just explain one last time on the Silke?
Ralph Silke, yeah, and it's pronounced Silke, by the way. You have the pronunciation right. S-E-E-L-K-E. Ralph, I'm going to be talking about his stuff in my new book, Darwin Strikes Back. He's basically taken bacteria, and he's knocked out one, two, or three of the units in key proteins in a multi-protein system. And then he's coaxed the bacteria. He's given them plenty of food and plenty of living structures in some of the other systems where they can get along, you know, without this system, okay? But the system would help them, and he can detect when the system comes back online, when it kind of re-evolves the missing parts for the protein, the key protein. And he just keeps working with them. And after about 1 year, a little over 1 year, I think it was, the one mutation clicked in, like he thought it would. When he knocked out two units, those group of bacteria have been going for, I think, 15 years, and they haven't been able to manage the two mutations. Even though he told me last week he's worked with 1 trillion bacteria. I can't even imagine numbers. That's 1,000 billion. He has worked with 1 trillion bacteria, and he's gone through 1,000 generations, and they can't manage the two mutation limit. And he says he has calculated if he had about 1,000 swimming pools, you know, Olympic-sized swimming pools, each filled with 1,000 trillion bacteria, and let them go for 1,000 trillion generations, they would get the two mutations. To go to three mutations, you could fill the entire universe with bacteria and let them mutate for 1 trillion years, and they wouldn't manage the three mutation limit. Now, when I hear that, I'm thinking, how can anyone believe that 100 amino acid bacteria could come about when 3 mutations are impossible in a single, you know, protein? I mean, I would say that crushes the Darwinian theory if you can't manage beyond 2 mutations. And I think Silkie's work is a bombshell. He applied for funding, by the way, to the National Institute of Health. And you know what the reply was? They said, he said, I want to study the evolution of difficult functions to see how improbable or improbable they are that they could come about by random mutation. The letter back from the funding analyst, they said, but what if you find out, what if you come back with negative results? And there was like, let me bury my head in the sand. I don't want to hear the bad news, you see. After all, we have faith, you know. And then the other thing, this is right on the end slides of his presentation. The other quote they got from one of these funding agencies said, well, we already know that we evolved. After all, we're here. I mean, when I hear that, that's like the death of thought. That's like the death of science. They don't want to even think. I mean, it's like, I'm an evolutionist. Oh, let me remove my brain. I mean, I'm getting mocking. I'm sorry. But I mean, when I hear stuff like that, how can science continue? Darwinism is committing suicide by not critically analyzing their own theory. They are so closed-minded in some cases. There are exceptions. My book has a footnote on page 83 where a guy named David Rout praised the scientific accuracy of Philip Johnson. And when I sign my book, I usually put 83FN, which means look at the footnote on page 83. It's the bombshell of my book. Now, Raup is my hero, because he said Darwinism needs intelligent design, and it needs it now. He's told me that in a letter. He watched a Behe lecture at Princeton University. He said, I praise Behe for his courage to go and present his theory. And I look forward to the day, this is what his letter ended. He said, I look forward to the day when intelligent design is treated as a valid theory for an open consideration in the university world. He's my hero. We need about 1 million more David Raups and 1 million less of the people who gave that answer to Silkie. What if we find negative results? Well, let the truth flow is what I say. Okay.
I go to Dresden University, and there's a class there which is taught by a professor that's a pastor, and he basically teaches that evolution, it occurred. It is also a creator, but it occurred through the creator, I mean through God.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, he proposes that the, you know, like the 1 day, 2 day thing, like it's not real. I just want to say that I could probably fight everything other, like I could argue to him all the other ways that I can prove that intelligent design is true.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how I can prove to him that the dating light years ago. I mean,
I wouldn't bother trying to deal with days. You know, like the days of creation. You mean?
I mean, like days in general, like light years, you know, like, I mean, I heard of a theory that says, you know, like light bends as it's, I don't know, I'm not able to read too much, but I heard that theory, but like that's basically what I mean. Like if they said that, you know, like stars are like this many billions of years away, and then we propose that the Earth is only 26,000 years old or whatever, so...
Mm-hmm. Why don't we get, we're just getting late. Can we go ahead and just, can I deal that with you, with that question personally? Because my answer would take too long, and we'd be here to midnight. Okay. Can I do that?
Sure.
Okay. And you, sir.
Well, thanks for your talk. Really
thank you. Appreciate it.
Actually, a public policy question. Mm. You know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you know, nobody is an evolutionist anymore. What will they teach in public schools? I mean,
okay, they will teach for another 10 years probably the Darwin theory as it's taught now, but they will gradually be forced by reality to teach the evidence, both pro and con, the problems with the theory. Secondly, I think that this OOF theory, the origination of organismal form, will begin to grow rapidly, and they will probably teach about that. I mean, for a while, that'll probably be the three paradigms, the fading Darwinian paradigm, the OOF paradigm, and eventually they'll begin to talk about intelligent design. I think within the next 5 years, they will find that the conditions of our culture have made it unavoidable to at least mention ID as a new competing theory. It's been wonderful to be with you. Thanks again for staying for this Q&A section. And if any of you have a burden for ministry and want to be trained for ministry at our beautiful Trinity College campus in Florida, see me. I'll give you information. We're Florida's first Bible college. Thank you.